Oliver Twist by Charles Dickens, Chapters 16, 17, and 18.
Chapter 16 relates what became of Oliver Twist after he had been claimed by Nancy. The narrow streets and courts at length terminated in a large open space scattered about which were pens for beasts and other indications of a cattle market. Sykes slackened his pace when they reached this spot, the girl being quite unable to support any longer the rapid rate at which they had hitherto walked. Turning to Oliver, he roughly commanded him to take hold of Nancy's hand. "Do you hear?" growled Sykes, as Oliver hesitated and looked around. They were in a dark corner, quite out of the track of passengers. Oliver saw, but too plainly, that resistance would be of no avail. He held out his hand, which Nancy clasped tight in hers. "Give me the other," said Sykes, seizing Oliver's unoccupied hand. "Here, Bullseye." The dog looked up and growled. "See here, boy," said Sykes, putting his other hand to Oliver's throat. "If he speaks ever so soft a word, hold him. Do you mind?" The dog growled again, and licking his lips, eyed Oliver as if he were anxious to attach himself to his windpipe without delay. "He's as willing as a Christian, strike me blind if he isn't," said Sykes, regarding the animal with a kind of grim and ferocious approval. "Now, you know what you've got to expect, master, so call away as quick as you like. The dog will soon stop that game. Get on, young'un." Bullseye wagged his tail in acknowledgment of this unusually endearing form of speech, and, giving vent to another admonitory growl for the benefit of Oliver, led the way onward. It was Smithfield that they were crossing, although it might have been Grosvenor Square for anything Oliver knew to the contrary. The night was dark and foggy. The lights in the shops could scarcely struggle through the heavy mist, which thickened every moment and shrouded the streets and houses in gloom, rendering the strange place still stranger in Oliver's eyes, and making his uncertainty the more dismal and depressing. They had hurried on a few paces when a deep church bell struck the hour. With its first stroke, his two conductors stopped and turned their heads in the direction whence the sound proceeded.
8 o'clock, Bill," said Nancy, when the bell ceased.
"What's the good of telling me that? I can hear it, can't I?" replied Sykes.
"I wonder whether they can hear it," said Nancy.
"Of course they can," replied Sykes. "It was Barnaby time when I was shopped, and there weren't a penny trumpet in the fair, as I couldn't hear the squeaking on. Arter I was locked up for the night, the row and din outside made the thundering old jail so silent that I could almost have beat my brains out against the iron plates of the door."
"Poor fellow," said Nancy, who still had her face turned towards the quarter in which the bell had sounded. "Oh, Bill, such fine young chaps as them."
"Yes, that's all you women think of," answered Sykes. "Fine young chaps. Well, they're as good as dead, so it don't much matter."
With this consolation, Mr. Sykes appeared to repress a rising tendency to jealousy, and clasping Oliver's wrist more firmly, told him to step out again.
"Wait a minute," said the girl. "I wouldn't hurry by if it was you that was coming out to be hung the next time 8 o'clock struck. Bill, I'd walk round and round the place till I dropped, if the snow was on the ground and I hadn't a shawl to cover me."
"And what good would that do?" inquired the unsentimental Mr. Sykes. "Unless you could pitch over a file and 20 yards of good stout rope, you might as well be walking 50 mile off or not walking at all, for all the good it would do me. Come on, and don't stand preaching there."
The girl burst into a laugh, drawing her shawl more closely around her, and they walked away. But Oliver felt her hand tremble, and looking up in her face as they passed a gas lamp, saw that it had turned a deadly white. They walked on, by little frequented and dirty ways, for a full half hour, meeting very few people, and those appearing from their looks to hold much the same position in society as Mr. Sykes himself. At length, they turned into a very filthy narrow street, nearly full of old clothes shops, the dog running forward as if conscious that there was no further occasion for his keeping on guard, stopped before the door of a shop that was closed and apparently untenanted. The house was in a ruinous condition, and on the door was nailed a board intimating that it was to let, which looked as if it had hung there for many years.
"All right," cried Sykes, glancing nervously about.
Nancy stooped below the shutters, and Oliver heard the sound of a bell. They crossed to the opposite side of the street and stood for a few moments under a lamp. A noise, as if a sash window were gently raised, was heard, and soon afterwards the door softly opened. Mr. Sykes then seized the terrified boy by the collar with very little ceremony, and all three were quickly inside the house. The passage was perfectly dark. They waited while the person who had let them in chained and barred the door.
"Anybody here?" inquired Sykes.
"Nope,"
replied a voice, which Oliver thought he had heard before.
"Is the old 'un here?" asked the robber.
"Yes," replied the voice, "and precious down in the mouth he has been. Won't he be glad to see you? Oh, no."
The style of this reply, as well as the voice which delivered it, seemed familiar to Oliver's ears, but it was impossible to distinguish even the form of the speaker in the darkness.
"Let's have a glim," said Sykes, "or we shall go breaking our necks or treading on the dog. Look after your legs if you do."
"Stand still a moment and I'll get you one," replied the voice.
The receding footsteps of the speaker were heard, and in another minute the form of Mr. John Dawkins, otherwise the Artful Dodger, appeared. He bore in his right hand a tallow candle stuck in the end of a cleft stick. The young gentleman did not stop to bestow any other mark of recognition upon Oliver than a humorous grin, but turning away, beckoned the visitors to follow him down a flight of stairs. They crossed an empty kitchen, and opening the door of a low, earthy-smelling room, which seemed to have been built in a small backyard, were received with a shout of laughter.
"Oh, my wig, my wig!"
cried Master Charlie Bates, from whose lungs the laughter had proceeded.
"Here he is! Oh, cry, here he is! Oh, Fagin, look at him! Fagin, do look at him! I can't bear it! It is such a jolly game! I can't bear it! Hold me, somebody, while I laugh it out!"
With this irrepressible ebullition of mirth, Master Bates laid himself flat on the floor and kicked convulsively for 5 minutes in an ecstasy of facetious joy. Then, jumping to his feet, he snatched the cleft stick from the dodger, and advancing to Oliver, viewed him round and round, while the Jew, taking off his nightcap, made a great number of low bows to the bewildered boy. The Artful, meantime, who was of a rather saturnine disposition and seldom gave way to merriment when it interfered with business, rifled Oliver's pockets with steady assiduity.
"Look at his togs, Fagin,"
said Charlie, putting the light so close to his new jacket as nearly to set him on fire.
"Look at his togs! Superfine cloth! And the heavy swell cut! Oh, my, what a game! And his books, too! Nothing but a gentleman, Fagin!"
"Delighted to see you looking so well, my dear," said the Jew, bowing with mock humility. "The Artful shall give you another suit, my dear, for fear you should spoil that Sunday one.
Why didn't you write, my dear, and say you were coming? We'd have got something warm for supper."
At this, Master Bates roared again, so loud that Fagin himself relaxed, and even the Dodger smiled. But as the Artful drew forth the 5-pound note at that instant, it is doubtful whether the sally of the discovery awakened his merriment.
"Hallo! What's that?" inquired Sykes, stepping forward as the Jew seized the note. "That's mine, Fagin."
"No, no, no, my dear," said the Jew. "Mine, Bill, mine. You shall have the books."
"If that ain't mine," said Bill Sykes, putting on his hat with a determined air. "Mine and Nancy's, that is. I'll take the boy back again."
The Jew started. Oliver started too, though from a very different cause, for he hoped that the dispute might really end in his being taken back.
"Come, hand over, will you?" said Sykes.
"This is hardly fair, Bill. Hardly fair, is it, Nancy?" inquired the Jew.
"Fair or not fair," retorted Sykes, "hand over, I tell you. Do you think Nancy and me has got nothing else to do with our precious time but to spend it in scouting ardor and kidnapping every young boy as gets grabbed through you? Give it here, you avaricious old skeleton. Give it here."
With this gentle remonstrance, Mr. Sykes plucked the note from between the Jew's finger and thumb, and looking the old man coolly in the face, folded it up small and tied it in his neckerchief.
"That's for our share of the trouble," said Sykes, "and not half enough, neither. You may keep the books if you're fond of reading. If you ain't, sell 'em."
"They're very pretty," said Charlie Bates, who, with sundry grimaces, had been affecting to read one of the volumes in question. "Beautiful writing, isn't it, Oliver?"
At sight of the dismayed look with which Oliver regarded his tormentors, Master Bates, who was blessed with a lively sense of the ludicrous, fell into another ecstasy, more boisterous than the first.
"They belong to the old gentleman," said Oliver, wringing his hands, "to the good, kind old gentleman who took me into his house and had me nursed when I was dying of the fever. Oh, pray send them back. Send back the books and money. Keep me here all my life, but pray, pray send them back. He'll think I stole them. The old lady, all of them who were so kind to me, will think I stole them. Oh, do have mercy upon me and send them back."
With these words, which were uttered with all the energy of passionate grief, Oliver fell upon his knees at the Jew's feet and beat his hands together in perfect desperation. "The boy's right," remarked Fagin, looking covertly around and knitting his shaggy eyebrows into a hard knot.
"You're right, Oliver, you're right. They will think you have stolen 'em." "Ha, ha," chuckled the Jew, rubbing his hands. "It couldn't have happened better if we had chosen our time."
"Of course it couldn't," replied Sykes. "I knowed that directly I see him coming through Clerkenwell with the books under his arm. It's all right enough. They're soft-hearted psalm singers, or they wouldn't have taken him in at all, and they'll ask no questions after him, fear they should be obliged to prosecute, and so get him lagged. He's safe enough."
Oliver had looked from one to the other while these words were being spoken, as if he were bewildered and could scarcely understand what passed. But when Bill Sykes concluded, he jumped suddenly to his feet and tore wildly from the room, uttering shrieks for help which made the bare old house echo to the roof.
"Keep back the dog, Bill!"
cried Nancy, springing before the door and closing it, as the Jew and his two pupils darted out in pursuit.
"Keep back the dog! He'll tear the boy to pieces!"
"Serve him right!" cried Sykes,
struggling to disengage himself from the girl's grasp.
"Stand off from me, or I'll split your head against the wall."
"I don't care for that, Bill. I don't care for that,"
screamed the girl, struggling violently with the man.
"The child shan't be torn down by the dog unless you kill me first."
"Shan't he?" said Sykes, setting his teeth. "I'll soon do that if you don't keep off."
The housebreaker flung the girl from him to the further end of the room, just as the Jew and the two boys returned, dragging Oliver among them.
"What's the matter here?" said Fagin, looking around. "The girl's gone mad, I think," replied Sykes savagely.
"No, she hasn't," said Nancy, pale and breathless from the scuffle. "No, she hasn't, Fagin. Don't think it."
"Then keep quiet, will you?" said the Jew with a threatening look.
"No, I won't do that neither," replied Nancy, speaking very loud. "Come, what do you think of that?"
Mr. Fagin was sufficiently well acquainted with the manners and customs of that particular species of humanity to which Nancy belonged to feel tolerably certain that it would be rather unsafe to prolong any conversation with her at present. With the view of diverting the attention of the company,
he turned to Oliver. "So you wanted to get away, my dear, did you?" said the Jew, taking up a jagged and knotted club which lay in a corner of the fireplace. "Eh?" Oliver made no reply, but he watched the Jew's motions and breathed quickly. "Wanted to get assistance? Called for the police, did you?" sneered the Jew, catching the boy by the arm. "We'll cure you of that, my young master." The Jew inflicted a smart blow on Oliver's shoulders with the club, and was raising it for a second when the girl, rushing forward, wrested it from his hand. She flung it into the fire with a force that brought some of the glowing coals whirling out into the room. "I won't stand by and see it done, Fagin," cried the girl. "You've got the boy, and what more would you have? Let him be, or I shall put that mark on some of you that will bring me to the gallows before my time." The girl stamped her foot violently on the floor as she vented this threat, and with her lips compressed and her hands clenched, looked alternately at the Jew and the other robber, her face quite colorless from the passion of rage into which she had gradually worked herself. "Why, Nancy," said the Jew in a soothing tone, after a pause during which he and Mr. Sykes had stared at one another in a disconcerted manner, "you're more clever than ever tonight. Ha-ha, my dear, you are acting beautifully."
"Am I?" said the girl. "Take care I don't overdo it. You will be the worse for it, Fagin, if I do, and so I tell you in good time to keep clear of me."
There is something about a roused woman, especially if she add to all her other strong passions the fierce impulses of recklessness and despair which few men like to provoke. The Jew saw that it would be hopeless to effect any further mistake regarding the reality of Miss Nancy's rage, and, shrinking involuntarily back a few paces, cast a glance, half imploring and half cowardly, at Sykes, as if to hint to him he was the fittest person to pursue the dialogue. Mr. Sykes, thus mutely appealed to, and possibly feeling his personal pride and influence interested in the immediate reduction of Miss Nancy to reason, gave utterance to about a couple of score of curses and threats, the rapid production of which reflected great credit on the fertility of his invention. As they produced no visible effect of the object against whom they were discharged, however, he resorted to more tangible arguments. "What do you mean by this?" said Sykes, backing the inquiry with a very common imprecation concerning the most beautiful of human features, which, if it were heard above, only once out of every 50,000 times that it is uttered below, would render blindness as a common disorder as measles. "What do you mean by it? Burn my body! Do you know who you are and what you are?" "Oh, yes, I know all about it," replied the girl, laughing hysterically and shaking her head from side to side with a poor assumption of indifference. "Well, then, keep quiet," rejoined Sykes, with a growl that, like he was accustomed to use when addressing his dog, "or I'll quiet you for a good long time to come." The girl laughed again, even less composedly than before, and darting a hasty look at Sykes, turned her face aside and bit her lip till the blood came. "You're a nice one," added Sykes, as he surveyed her with a contemptuous air, "to take up the humane and genteel side. A pretty subject for the child, as you call him, to make a friend of."
"God Almighty help me, I am," cried the girl passionately, "and I wish I had been struck dead in the street, or had changed places with them we passed so near tonight, before I had lent a hand in bringing him here. He's a thief, a liar, a devil, all that's bad from this night forth. Isn't that enough for the old wretch without blows?"
"Come, come, Sykes," said the Jew, appealing to him in a remonstratory tone, and motioning towards the boys, who were eagerly attentive to all that passed. "We must have civil words. Civil words, Bill."
"Civil words!" cried the girl, whose passion was frightful to see. "Civil words, you villain!
Yes, you deserve 'em from me. I thieved for you when I was a child not half as old as this," pointing to Oliver.
I have been in the same trade and in the same service for 12 years since. Don't you know it? Speak out! Don't you know it?"
"Well, well," replied the Jew, with an attempt at pacification, "and if you have, it's your living."
"Aye, it is," returned the girl, not speaking but pouring out the words in one continuous and vehement scream. "It is my living, and the cold, wet, dirty streets are my home, and you're the wretch that drove me to them long ago, and that'll keep me there day and night till I die."
"I shall do you a mischief," interposed the Jew, goaded by these reproaches. "A mischief worse than that, if you say much more."
The girl said nothing more, but tearing her hair and dress in a transport of passion, made such a rush at the Jew as would probably have left signal marks of her revenge upon him, had not her wrists been seized by Sikes at the right moment, upon which she made a few ineffectual struggles and fainted.
"She's all right now," said Sikes, laying her down in a corner. "She's uncommon strong in the arms when she's up in this way."
The Jew wiped his forehead and smiled, as if it were a relief to have the disturbance over. But neither he nor Sikes, nor the dog, nor the boys, seemed to consider it in any other light than a common occurrence incidental to business.
"It's the worst of having to do with women," said the Jew, replacing his club. "But they're clever, and we can't get on in our line without 'em. Charlie, show Oliver to bed."
"I suppose he'd better not wear his best clothes tomorrow, Fagin, had he?" inquired Charlie Bates.
"Certainly not," replied the Jew, reciprocating the grin with which Charlie put the question.
Master Bates, apparently much delighted with his commission, took the cleft stick and led Oliver into an adjacent kitchen, where there were two or three of the beds on which he had slept before. And here, with many uncontrollable bursts of laughter, he produced the identical old suit of clothes which Oliver had so much congratulated himself upon leaving off at Mr. Brownlow's, and the accidental display of which to Fagin, by the Jew who purchased them, had been the very first clue received of his whereabout.
"Put off the smart ones," said Charlie, "and I'll give 'em to Fagin to take care of. What fun it is!"
Poor Oliver unwillingly complied. Master Bates, rolling up the new clothes under his arm, departed from the room, leaving Oliver in the dark and locking the door behind him. The noise of Charlie's laughter and the voice of Miss Betsy, who opportunely arrived to throw water over her friend and perform other feminine offices for the promotion of her recovery, might have kept many people awake under more happy circumstances than those in which Oliver was placed. But he was sick and weary, and he soon fell sound asleep.
Chapter 17. Oliver's destiny continuing unpropitious brings a great man to London to injure his reputation. It is the custom on the stage in all good murderous melodramas to present the tragic and the comic scenes in as regular alternation as the layers of red and white in a side of streaky bacon. The hero sinks upon his straw bed, weighed down by fetters and misfortunes. In the next scene, his faithful but unconscious squire regales the audience with a comic song. We behold, with throbbing bosoms, the heroine in the grasp of a proud and ruthless baron, her virtue and her life alike in danger, drawing forth her dagger to preserve the one at the cost of the other, and just as our expectations are wrought up to the highest pitch, a whistle is heard, and we are straightway transported to the great hall of the castle, where a gray-headed seneschal sings a funny chorus with a funnier body of vassals, who are free of all sorts of places, from church vaults to palaces, and roam about in company, caroling perpetually. Such changes appear absurd, but they are not so unnatural as they would seem at first sight. The transitions in real life, from well-spread boards to deathbeds, and from mourning weeds to holiday garments, are not a whit less startling. Only there we are busy actors instead of passive lookers-on, which makes a vast difference. The actors in the mimic life of the theater are blind to violent transitions and abrupt impulses of passion or feeling, which, presented before the eyes of mere spectators, are at once condemned as outrageous and preposterous. As sudden shiftings of the scene and rapid changes of time and place are not only sanctioned in books by long usage, but are by many considered as the great art of authorship, an author's skill in his craft being, by such critics, chiefly estimated with relation to the dilemmas in which he leaves his characters at the end of every chapter. This brief introduction to the present one may perhaps be deemed necessary. If so, let it be considered a delicate intimation on the part of the historian that he is going back to the town in which Oliver Twist was born, the reader taking it for granted that there are good and substantial reasons for making the journey, or he would not be invited to proceed upon such an expedition. Mr. Bumble emerged at early morning from the workhouse gate and walked with portly carriage and commanding steps up the high street. He was in the full bloom and pride of beetlehood. His cocked hat and coat were dazzling in the morning sun. He clutched his cane with the vigorous tenacity of health and power. Mr. Bumble always carried his head high, but this morning it was higher than usual. There was an abstraction in his eye, an elevation in his air, which might have warned an observant stranger that thoughts were passing in the beetle's mind too great for utterance. Mr. Bumble stopped not to converse with the small shopkeepers and others who spoke to him deferentially as he passed along. He merely returned their salutations with a wave of his hand, and relaxed not in his dignified pace until he reached the farm where Mrs. Mann tended the infant paupers with parochial care. "Draft that beetle!" said Mrs. Mann, hearing the well-known shaking at the garden gate. "If it isn't him at this time in the morning!" "Lark, Mr. Bumble, only think of its being you! Well, dear me, it is a pleasure, this is. Come into the parlor, sir, please." The first sentence was addressed to Susan, and the exclamations of delight were uttered to Mr. Bumble as the good lady unlocked the garden gate and showed him, with great attention and respect, into the house. "Mrs. Mann," said Mr. Bumble, not sitting upon or dropping himself into a seat as any common jackanapes would, but letting himself gradually and slowly down into a chair. "Mrs. Mann, ma'am, good morning." "Well, and good morning to you, sir," replied Mrs. Mann with many smiles, "and hoping you find yourself well, sir." So, Mrs. Mann," replied the beetle. "A parochial life is not a bed of roses, Mrs. Mann." "Ah, that it isn't indeed, Mr. Bumble," rejoined the lady, and all the infant paupers might have chorused the rejoinder with great propriety if they had heard it. "A parochial life, ma'am," continued Mr. Bumble, striking the table with his cane, "is a life of worrit and vexation and hardihood. But all public characters, as I may say, must suffer prosecution." Mrs. Mann, not very well knowing what the beetle meant, raised her hands with a look of sympathy and sighed. "Ah, you may well sigh, Mrs. Mann," said the beetle. Finding she had done right, Mrs. Mann sighed again, evidently to the satisfaction of the public character, who, repressing a complacent smile by looking sternly at his cocked hat, said, "Mrs. Mann, I'm going to London." "Lawk, Mr. Bumble!" cried Mrs. Mann, starting back. "To London, ma'am," resumed the inflexible beetle, "by coach. I and two paupers, Mrs. Mann. A legal action is a-coming on about a settlement, and the board has appointed me, Mrs. Mann, to dispose to the matter before the quarter sessions at Clerkenwell. And I very much question," added Mr. Bumble, drawing himself up, "whether the Clerkenwell sessions will not find themselves in the wrong box before they have done with me." "Oh, you mustn't be too hard upon them, sir," said Mrs. Mann coaxingly. The Clerkingwell Sessions have brought it upon themselves, ma'am, replied Mr. Bumble. And if the Clerkingwell Sessions find that they come off rather worse than they expected, the Clerkingwell Sessions have only themselves to thank. There was so much determination and depth of purpose about the menacing manner in which Mr. Bumble delivered himself of these words that Mrs. Mann appeared quite awed by them. At length she said, "You're going by coach, sir? I thought it was always usual to send them paupers in carts." "That's when they're ill, Mrs. Mann," said the beadle. "We put the sick paupers into open carts in the rainy weather to prevent their taking cold." "Oh," said Mrs. Mann. "The opposition coach contracts for these two and takes them cheap," said Mr. Bumble. "They are both in a very low state, and we find it would come £2 cheaper to move them than to bury them. That is, if we can throw them upon another parish, which I think we shall be able to do if they don't die upon the road to spite us." When Mr. Bumble had laughed a little while, his eyes again encountered the cocked hat, and he became grave. "We are forgetting business, ma'am," said the beadle. "Here is your parochial stipend for the month." Mr. Bumble produced some silver money rolled up in paper from his pocketbook and requested a receipt, which Mrs. Mann wrote. "It's very much blotted, sir," said the farmer of infants, "but it's formal enough, I dare say. Thank you, Mr. Bumble, sir. I am very much obliged to you, I'm sure." Mr. Bumble nodded blandly in acknowledgment of Mrs. Mann's curtsy and inquired how the children were. "Bless their dear little hearts," said Mrs. Mann with emotion. "They're as well as can be, the dears, of course, except the two that died last week, and little Dick." "Isn't that boy no better?" inquired Mr. Bumble. Mrs. Mann shook her head. "He's a ill-conditioned, vicious, bad-deposed, parochial child, that," said Mr. Bumble angrily. "Where is he?" "I'll bring him to you in 1 minute, sir," replied Mrs. Mann. "Here, you, Dick!" After some calling, Dick was discovered. Having had his face put under the pump and dried upon Mrs. Mann's gown, he was led into the awful presence of Mr. Bumble, the beadle. The child was pale and thin, his cheeks were sunken, and his eyes large and bright. The scanty parish dress, the livery of his misery, hung loosely on his feeble body, and his young limbs had wasted away like those of an old man. Such was the little being who stood trembling beneath Mr. Bumble's glance, not daring to lift his eyes from the floor, and dreading even to hear the beadle's voice. "Can't you look at the gentleman, you obstinate boy?" said Mrs. Mann. The child meekly raised his eyes and encountered those of Mr. Bumble. "What's the matter with you, parochial Dick?" inquired Mr. Bumble with well-timed jocularity.
"Nothing, sir," replied the child faintly. "I should think not," said Mrs. Mann, who had, of course, laughed very much at Mr. Bumble's humor.
"You want for nothing, I'm sure."
"I should like," faltered this child.
"Heyday!" interposed Mrs. Mann. "I suppose you're going to say that you do want for something now. Why, you little wretch." "Stop, Mrs. Mann, stop," said the beadle, raising his hand with a show of authority. "Like what, sir?" "Eh?"
"I should like," faltered the child, "if somebody that can write would put a few words down for me on a piece of paper and fold it up and seal it and keep it for me after I'm laid in the ground."
"Why, what does a boy mean?"
exclaimed Mr. Bumble, on whom the earnest manner and wan aspect of the child had made some impression, accustomed as he was to such things.
"What do you mean, sir?"
"I should like," said the child, "to leave my dear love to poor Oliver Twist, and to let him know how often I have sat by myself and cried to think of his wandering about in the dark nights with nobody to help him. And I should like to tell him," said the child, pressing his small hands together and speaking with great fervor, "that I was glad to die when I was very young, for perhaps if I had lived to be a man and had grown old, my little sister who is in heaven might forget me or be unlike me, and it would be so much happier if we were both children there together." Mr. Bumble surveyed the little speaker from head to foot with indescribable astonishment, and turning to his companion said,
"They're all in one story, Mrs. Mann. That audacious Oliver had demogalized them all."
"I couldn't have believed it, sir," said Mrs. Mann, holding up her hands and looking malignantly at Dick. "I never see such a hardened little wretch."
"Take him away, ma'am," said Mr. Bumble imperiously. "This must be stated to the board, Mrs. Mann."
"I hope the gentleman will understand that it isn't my fault, sir," said Mrs. Mann, whimpering pathetically.
"They shall understand that, ma'am. They shall be acquainted with the true state of the case," said Mr. Bumble. "There, take him away. I can't bear the sight on him."
Dick was immediately taken away and locked up in the coal cellar. Mr. Bumble shortly afterwards took himself off to prepare for his journey. At 6 o'clock next morning, Mr. Bumble, having exchanged his cocked hat for a round one and encased his person in a blue great coat with a cape to it, took his place on the outside of the coach, accompanied by the criminals whose settlement was disputed, with whom, in due course of time, he arrived in London. He experienced no other crosses on the way than those which originated in the perverse behavior of the two paupers, who persisted in shivering and complaining of the cold in a manner which, Mr. Bumble declared, caused his teeth to chatter in his head and made him feel quite uncomfortable, although he had a great coat on. Having disposed of these evil-minded persons for the night, Mr. Bumble sat himself down in the house at which the coach stopped, and took a temperate dinner of steaks, oyster sauce, and porter. Putting a glass of hot gin and water on the chimney piece, he drew his chair to the fire, and with sundry moral reflections on the too prevalent sin of discontent and complaining, composed himself to read the paper. The very first paragraph upon which Mr. Bumble's eyes rested was the following advertisement: 5 guineas reward. Whereas a young boy named Oliver Twist absconded, or was enticed on Thursday evening last from his home at Pentonville, and has not since been heard of. The above reward will be paid to any person who will give such information as will lead to the discovery of the said Oliver Twist, or tend to throw any light upon his previous history, in which the advertiser is, for many reasons, warmly interested. And then followed a full description of Oliver's dress, person, appearance, and disappearance, with the name and address of Mr. Brownlow at full length. Mr. Bumble opened his eyes, read the advertisement slowly and carefully 3 several times, and in something more than 5 minutes was on his way to Pentonville, having actually, in his excitement, left the glass of hot gin and water untasted. "Is Mr. Brownlow at home?" inquired Mr. Bumble of the girl who opened the door. To this inquiry the girl returned a not uncommon, but rather evasive reply of, "I don't know. Where do you come from?" Mr. Bumble no sooner uttered Oliver's name in explanation of his errand than Mrs. Bedwin, who had been listening at the parlor door, hastened into the passage in a breathless state. "Come in, come in," said the old lady. "I knew we should hear of him, poor dear. I knew we should. I was certain of it. Bless his heart. I said so all along." Having heard this, the worthy old lady hurried back into the parlor again, and seating herself on a sofa, burst into tears. The girl, who was not quite so susceptible, had run upstairs meanwhile, and now returned with a request that Mr. Bumble would follow her immediately, which he did. He was shown into the tiny little back study where sat Mr. Brownlow and his friend, Mr. Grimwig, with decanters and glasses before them. The latter gentleman at once burst into the exclamation, "A beetle, a parish beetle, or I'll eat my head." "Pray don't interrupt just now," said Mr. Brownlow. "Take a seat, will you?" Mr. Bumble sat himself down, quite confounded by the oddity of Mr. Grimwig's manner. Mr. Brownlow moved the lamp so as to obtain an uninterrupted view of the beetle's countenance, and said with a little impatience, "Now, sir, you come in consequence of having seen the advertisement?"
"Yes, sir,"
said Mr. Bumble. "And you are a beetle, are you not?" inquired Mr. Grimwig.
"I am a parochial beetle, gentlemen," rejoined Mr. Bumble proudly. "Of course,
observed Mr. Grimwig, aside to his friend. I knew he was, a beetle all over. Mr. Brownlow gently shook his head to impose silence on his friend and resumed. Do you know where this poor boy is now? No more than nobody, replied Mr. Bumble. Well, what do you know of him? Inquired the old gentleman. Speak out, my friend, if you have anything to say. What do you know of him? You don't happen to know any good of him, do you? Said Mr. Grimwig, caustically, after an attentive perusal of Mr. Bumble's features. Mr. Bumble, catching at the inquiry, very quickly shook his head with portentous solemnity. You see, said Mr. Grimwig, looking triumphantly at Mr. Brownlow. Mr. Brownlow looked apprehensively at Mr. Bumble's pursed-up countenance and requested him to communicate what he knew regarding Oliver in as few words as possible. Mr. Bumble put down his hat, unbuttoned his coat, folded his arms, inclined his head in a retrospective manner, and after a few moments' reflection, commenced his story. It would be tedious if given in the beetle's words, occupying as it did some 20 minutes in the telling, but the sum and substance of it was that Oliver was a foundling, born of low and vicious parents, that he had from his birth displayed no better qualities than treachery, ingratitude, and malice, that he had terminated his brief career in the place of his birth by making a sanguinary and cowardly attack on an unoffending lad and running away in the nighttime from his master's house. In proof of his really being the person he represented himself, Mr. Bumble laid upon the table the papers he had brought to town. Folding his arms again, he then awaited Mr. Brownlow's observations. I fear it's all too true, said the old gentleman sorrowfully, after looking over the papers. This is not much for your intelligence, but I would gladly have given you treble the money if it had been favorable to the boy. It is not improbable that if Mr. Bumble had been possessed of this information at an earlier period of the interview, he might have imparted a very different coloring to his little history. It was too late to do it now, however, so he shook his head gravely, and pocketing the 5 guineas, withdrew. Mr. Brownlow paced the room to and fro for some minutes, evidently so much disturbed by the beetle's tale that even Mr. Grimwig forbore to vex him further. At length he stopped and rang the bell violently. Mrs. Bedwin, said Mr. Brownlow when the housekeeper appeared, that boy Oliver is an impostor. It can't be, sir, cannot be, said the old lady energetically. I tell you he is, retorted the old gentleman. What do you mean by can't be? We have just heard a full account of him from his birth, and he has been a thorough-paced little villain all his life. I never will believe it, sir, replied the old lady firmly. Never! The old woman never believed anything but quack doctors and lying storybooks, growled Mr. Grimwig. I knew it all along. Why didn't you take my advice in the beginning? You would if he hadn't had a fever, I suppose, eh? He was interesting, wasn't he? Interesting, pah! And Mr. Grimwig poked the fire with a flourish. He was a dear, grateful, gentle child, sir, retorted Mrs. Bedwin indignantly. I know what children are, sir, and have done these 40 years, and people who can't say the same shouldn't say anything about them. That's my opinion. This was a hard hit at Mr. Grimwig, who was a bachelor. As it extorted nothing from that gentleman but a smile, the old lady tossed her head and smoothed down her apron preparatory to another speech, when she was stopped by Mr. Brownlow. Silence! Said the old gentleman, feigning an anger he was far from feeling. Never let me hear the boy's name again. I rang to tell you that. Never, never on any pretense, mind. You may leave the room, Mrs. Bedwin. Remember, I am in earnest. There were sad hearts at Mr. Brownlow's that night. Oliver's heart sank within him when he thought of his good friends. It was well for him that he could not know what they had heard, or it might have broken outright.
Chapter 18. How Oliver passed his time in the improving society of his reputable friends. About noon next day, When the Dodger and Master Bates had gone out to pursue their customary avocations, Mr. Fagin took the opportunity of reading Oliver a long lecture on the crying sin of ingratitude, of which he clearly demonstrated he had been guilty to no ordinary extent in willfully absenting himself from the society of his anxious friends, and still more, in endeavoring to escape from them after so much trouble and expense had been incurred in his recovery. Mr. Fagin laid great stress on the fact of his having taken Oliver in and cherished him when, without his timely aid, he might have perished with hunger, and he related the dismal and affecting history of a young lad whom, in his philanthropy, he had succored under parallel circumstances, but who, proving unworthy of his confidence and evincing a desire to communicate with the police, had unfortunately come to be hanged at the Old Bailey one morning. Mr. Fagin did not seek to conceal his share in the catastrophe, but lamented with tears in his eyes that the wrong-headed and treacherous behavior of the young person in question had rendered it necessary that he should become the victim of certain evidence for the Crown, which, if it were not precisely true, was indispensably necessary for the safety of him, Mr. Fagin, and a few select friends. Mr. Fagin concluded by drawing a rather disagreeable picture of the discomforts of hanging, and, with great friendliness and politeness of manner, expressed his anxious hopes that he might never be obliged to submit Oliver Twist to that unpleasant operation. Little Oliver's blood ran cold as he listened to the Jew's words and imperfectly comprehended the dark threats conveyed in them. That it was possible, even for justice itself, to confound the innocent with the guilty when they were in accidental companionship. He knew already, and that deeply laid plans for the destruction of inconveniently knowing or over-communicative persons had been really devised and carried out by the Jew on more occasions than one, he thought by no means unlikely, when he recollected the general nature of the altercations between the gentleman and Mr. Sykes, which seemed to bear reference in some foregone conspiracy of the kind. As he glanced timidly up and met the Jew's searching look, he felt that his pale face and trembling limbs were neither unnoticed nor unrelished by that weary old gentleman. The Jew, smiling hideously, patted Oliver on the head and said that if he kept himself quiet and applied himself to business, he saw they would be very good friends yet. Then, taking his hat and covering himself with an old patched gray coat, he went out and locked the room door behind him. And so Oliver remained all that day, and for the greater part of many subsequent days, seeing nobody between early morning and midnight, and left during the long hours to commune with his own thoughts, which never failing to revert to his kind friends and the opinion they must long ago have formed of him, were sad indeed. After the lapse of a week or so, the Jew left the room door unlocked, and he was at liberty to wander about the house. It was a very dirty place. The rooms upstairs had great high wooden chimney pieces and large doors, with paneled walls and cornices to the ceiling, which, although they were black with neglect and dust, were ornamented in various ways. From all these tokens, Oliver concluded that a long time ago, before the old Jew was born, it had belonged to better people and had perhaps been quite gay and handsome, dismal and dreary as it looked now. Spiders had built their webs in the angles of the walls and ceilings, and sometimes when Oliver walked softly into the room, the mice would scamper across the floor and run back terrified to their holes. With these exceptions, there was neither sight nor sound of any living thing, and often, when it grew dark and he was tired of wandering from room to room, he would crouch in the corner of the passage by the street door to be as near living people as he could, and would remain there listening and counting the hours until the Jew or the boys returned. In all the rooms, the moldering shutters were fast closed. The bars which held them were screwed tight into the wood, the only light which was admitted stealing its way through round holes at the top, which made the rooms more gloomy, and filled them with strange shadows. There was a back garret window with rusty bars outside, which had no shutter, and out of this Oliver often gazed with a melancholy face for hours together, but nothing was to be descried from it but a confused and crowded mass of housetops, blackened chimneys, and gable ends. Sometimes, indeed, a grisly head might be seen, peering over the parapet wall of a distant house, but it was quickly withdrawn again, and as the window of Oliver's observatory was nailed down and dimmed with the rain and smoke of years, it was as much as he could do to make out the forms of the different objects beyond, without making any attempt to be seen or heard, which he had as much chance of being as if he had lived inside the ball of St. Paul's Cathedral. One afternoon, the Dodger and Master Bates being engaged out that evening, the first-named young gentleman took it into his head to evince some anxiety regarding the decoration of his person. To do him justice, this was by no means an habitual weakness with him. And, with this end in aim, he condescendingly commanded Oliver to assist him in his toilet straightway. Oliver was but too glad to make himself useful, too happy to have some faces, however bad, to look upon, too desirous to conciliate those about him when he could honestly do so, to throw an objection in the way of the proposal. So he at once expressed his readiness, and kneeling on the floor, while the Dodger sat upon the table so that he could take his foot in his laps, he applied himself to a process which Mr. Dawkins designated as japanning his trotter cases. The phrase, rendered into plain English, signifieth cleaning his boots. Whether it was the sense of freedom and independence which a rational animal may be supposed to feel when he sits on a table in an easy attitude smoking a pipe, swinging one leg carelessly to and fro, and having his boots clean all the time, without even the past trouble of having taken them off, or the prospective misery of putting them on, to disturb his reflections, or whether it was the goodness of the tobacco that soothed the feelings of the Dodger, or the mildness of the beer that mollified his thoughts. He was evidently tinctured for the nonce with a spice of romance and enthusiasm foreign to his general nature. He looked down on Oliver with a thoughtful countenance for a brief space, and then raising his head and heaving a gentle sigh, said, half in abstraction and half to Master Bates, "What a pity it is he isn't a prig." "Ah," said Master Charles Bates, "he don't know what's good for him." The Dodger sighed again and resumed his pipe, as did Charlie Bates. They both smoked for some seconds in silence. "I suppose you don't even know what a prig is," said Dodger mournfully. "I think I know that," replied Oliver, looking up. "It's a... you're one, are you not?" inquired Oliver, checking himself. "I am," replied the Dodger. "I'd scorn to be anything else." And Mr. Dawkins gave his hat a ferocious cock after delivering the sentiment, and looked at Master Bates as if to denote that he would feel obliged by his saying anything to the contrary. "I am," repeated the Dodger. "So's Charlie. So's Fagin. So's Sykes. So's Nancy. So's Bet. So we all are, down to the dog. And he's the downiest one of the lot. And the least given to peaching," added Charlie Bates. "He wouldn't so much as bark in a witness box for fear of committing himself. No, not if you tied him up in one and left him there without whittles for a fortnight," said the Dodger. "Not a bit of it," observed Charlie. "He's a rum dog. Don't he look fierce at any strange cove that laughs or sings when he's in company?" pursued the Dodger. "Won't he growl at all when he hears a fiddle playing? And don't he hate other dogs as ain't of his breed?" "Oh, no. He's an out-and-out Christian," said Charlie. This was merely intended as a tribute to the animal's abilities. But it was an appropriate remark in another sense, if Master Bates had only known it. for there are a good many ladies and gentlemen claiming to be out-and-out Christians between whom and Mr. Sykes' dog there exist strong and singular points of resemblance. Well, well, said the Dodger, recurring to the point from which they had strayed, with that mindfulness of his profession which influenced all his proceedings. That hasn't got anything to do with young Green here. No more it has, said Charlie. Why don't you put yourself under Fagin, Oliver, and make your fortune out of hand, added the Dodger with a grin, and so be able to retire on your property and do the genteel, as I mean to, in the very next leap year, but four that ever comes, and the 42nd Tuesday in Trinity Week, said Charlie Bates. I don't like it, rejoined Oliver timidly. I wish they would let me go. I would rather go. And Fagin would rather not, rejoined Charlie. Oliver knew this too well, but thinking it might be dangerous to express his feelings more openly, he only sighed and went on with his boot cleaning. Go, exclaimed the Dodger. Why, where's your spirit? Don't you take any pride out of yourself? Would you go and be dependent on your friends? Oh, blow that, said Master Bates, drawing two or three silk handkerchiefs from his pocket and tossing them into a cupboard. That's too mean, that is. I couldn't do it, said the Dodger, with an air of haughty disgust. You can leave your friends, though, said Oliver, with a half smile, and let them be punished for what you did. That, rejoined the Dodger, with a wave of his pipe, that was all out of consideration for Fagin, because the traps know that we work together, and he might have gotten into trouble if we hadn't made our lucky. That was the move, wasn't it, Charlie? Master Bates nodded assent, and would have spoken, but the recollection of Oliver's flight came so suddenly upon him that the smoke he was inhaling got entangled with a laugh, and went up into his head and down into his throat, and brought on a fit of coughing and stamping about 5 minutes long. Look here, said the Dodger, drawing forth a handful of shillings and halfpence. Here's a jolly life. What's the odds where it comes from? Here, catch hold. There's plenty more where they were took from. You won't you? Oh, you precious flat. It's naughty, ain't it, Oliver? Inquired Charlie Bates. He'll come to be scragged, won't he? I don't know what that means, replied Oliver. Something in this way, old fellow, said Charlie. As he said it, Master Bates caught up an end of his neckerchief, and holding it erect in the air, dropped his head on his shoulder, and jerked a curious sound through his teeth, thereby indicating, by a lively pantomimic representation, that scragging and hanging were one and the same thing. That's what it means, said Charlie. Look how he stares, Jack. I never did see such prime company as that ere boy. He'll be the death of me. I know he will, Master Bates, having laughed heartily again, resumed his pipe with tears in his eyes. You've been brought up bad, said the Dodger, surveying his boots with much satisfaction when Oliver had polished them. Fagin will make something out of you, though, or you'll be the first he ever had that turned out unprofitable. You'd better begin at once, for you'll come to the trade long before you think of it, and you're only losing time, Oliver. Master Bates backed his advice with sundry moral admonitions of his own, which, being exhausted, he and his friend Mr. Dawkins launched into a glowing description of the numerous pleasures incidental to the life they led, interspersed with a variety of hints to Oliver that the best thing he could do would be to secure Fagin's favor without more delay, by the means which they themselves had employed to gain it. And always put this in your pipe, Nolly, said the Dodger, as the Jew was heard unlocking the door above, if you don't take Fogles and Tickers. What's the good of talking in that way, interposed Master Bates. He don't know what you mean. If you don't take pocket handkerchiefs and watches, said the Dodgers, reducing his conversation to the level of Oliver's capacity, some other cove will, so that the coves that lose them will be all the worse, and you'll be all the worse too, and nobody half a ha'porth the better, except the chaps what gets them, and you've just as good a right to them as they have. to be sure, said the Jew, who had entered unseen by Oliver. It all lies in a nutshell, my dear, in a nutshell. Take the Dodger's word for it. He understands the catechism of his trade. The old man rubbed his hands gleefully together as he corroborated the Dodger's reasoning in these terms and chuckled with delight at his pupil's proficiency. The conversation proceeded no farther at this time, for the Jew had returned home accompanied by Miss Betsy and a gentleman whom Oliver had never seen before, but who was accosted by the Dodger as Tom Chitling, and who, having lingered on the stairs to exchange a few gallantries with the lady, now made his appearance. Mr. Chitling was older in years than the Dodger, having perhaps numbered 18 winters, but there was a degree of deference in this deportment towards that young gentleman which seemed to indicate that he felt himself conscious of a slight inferiority in point of genius and professional acquirements. He had small twinkling eyes and a pockmarked face, wore a fur cap, a dark corduroy jacket, greasy fustian trousers, and an apron. His wardrobe was, in truth, rather out of repair, but he excused himself to the company by stating that his time was only out an hour before, and that, in consequence of having worn the regimentals for 6 weeks past, he had not been able to bestow any attention on his private clothes. Mr. Chitling added, with strong marks of irritation, that the new way of fumigating clothes by yonder was infernal unconstitutional, for it burnt holes in them, and there was no remedy against the county. The same remark he considered to apply to the regulation mode of cutting the hair, which he held to be decidedly unlawful. Mr. Chitling wound up his observations by stating he had not touched a drop of anything for 42 more long, hard-working days, that he had wished he might be busted if he weren't as dry as a lime basket. "Where do you think the gentleman has come from, Oliver?" inquired the Jew with a grin as the other boys put a bottle of spirits on the table. "I don't know, sir," replied Oliver. "Who's that?" inquired Tom Chitling, casting a contemptuous look at Oliver. "A young friend of mine, my dear," replied the Jew. "He's in luck, then," said the young man, with a meaning look at Fagin. "Never mind where I came from, young'un. You'll find your way there. Soon enough, I'll bet a crown." At this sally, the boys laughed. After some more jokes on the same subject, they exchanged a few short whispers with Fagin and withdrew. After some words apart between the last comer and Fagin, they drew their chairs towards the fire, and the Jew, telling Oliver to come and sit by him, led the conversation to the topics most calculated to interest his hearers. These were the great advantages of the trade, the proficiency of the Dodger, the amiability of Charlie Bates, and the liberality of the Jew himself. At length these subjects displayed signs of being thoroughly exhausted, and Mr. Chitling did the same, for the house of correction becomes fatiguing after a week or two. Miss Betsy accordingly withdrew and left the party to their repose. From this day, Oliver was seldom left alone, but was placed in almost constant communication with the two boys, who played the old game with the Jew every day. Whether for their own improvement or Oliver's, Mr. Fagin best knew. At other times, the old man would tell them stories of robberies he had committed in his younger days, mixed up with so much that was droll and curious that Oliver could not help laughing heartily and showing that he was amused in spite of all of his better feelings. In short, the wily old Jew had the boy in his toils. Having prepared his mind by solitude and gloom to prefer any society to the companionship of his own sad thoughts in such a dreary place, he was now slowly instilling into his soul the poison which he hoped would blacken it and change its hue forever.